I'm Charles Tart. I'm a psychologist with a special interest in transpersonal psychology, parapsychology, altered states of consciousness. I'm interested in the human mind, basically, and perhaps what you might like to call the human soul, and what we can find out about it, what it means for our lives. My definition of transpersonal psychology relates it to the idea of a soul. Okay, ordinary psychology is defined as the study of behavior, as if it's caused entirely by electrochemical reactions in the brain. But I use soul in the very old-fashioned sense of the term, of something different from just our physical aspect, something that might survive death, something that's responsible for our spiritual nature. Put it more generally, what it's formally defined as is taking that prefix trans, T-R-A-N-S, to mean things that are beyond our personal self. Ordinarily, I sit here, I'm in a body, I have a social identity, I have a particular personal history, I have my habits, my hopes and fears and all that. I'm very constricted and located at this point in space and time. But people have transpersonal experiences, spiritual experiences, where they feel as if there's something much bigger than just their ordinary biological identity. Transpersonal psychology is the study of those experiences, learning how to induce them, learning how to train them, trying to understand what they mean. Put it another way, transpersonal psychology is about trying to make the spiritual real and effective in contemporary life. You know, some people can pick up an old spiritual system, an old religion, and have it work for them. And for an awful lot of people, it doesn't work. It might have worked for people in the 1800s or the 800s or something like that. But we need a spirituality that works for people who live in the 21st century. And that's one of the main jobs of transpersonal psychology, to sort through all these things we've inherited and find, this is so full of cultural artifacts, it's not going to work here. This is the essential practice, which does work here, and learn how to make that stuff work well. So, you know, I don't want to say that in a messianic kind of way, because there is a real scholarly bent here. We want to get at the truth, not just emotional satisfaction, but the truth. But we have a general confidence that the truth is that we are spiritual beings, and that part of us needs to be nourished and grow. I came into psychology close to 50 years ago now. Psychology was very behavioristic in its orientation. Psychologists wanted to be real scientists, and they wanted to be objective, and people's experiences were considered subjective, and so you couldn't study them scientifically. So the emphasis was on behavior, which was fine as a partial view, but as a total view of human nature was sort of silly. Because most of the most interesting and meaningful things in life are experiences that happen inside, not external behavior. Well, I wasn't buying that orientation. I figured psychology in the old-fashioned sense was the study of the human mind, and behavior was one aspect of it, but only one aspect. So I became interested in things like hypnosis and altered states of consciousness, and thought it's a good thing that people could talk, that you can ask them about their experiences. Of course, there are difficulties. You know, people don't describe things very accurately sometimes. But better to go at the important stuff and deal with the difficulties as they come up than to simplify the field so much that it's very objective but kind of trivial, which is where psychology was. Now, 50 years later, there's a lot of improvement, but not enough. Consciousness is a somewhat respectable thing for people to study now. But it's still being conceived of as too narrow a way. You know, there's a problem with psychologists. We're insecure. we'd like to be real scientists, like physicists and chemists and all those people. And so there's a tendency to copy the methods of the physical sciences. And that works real well for a few things, but it leaves out most of the most interesting subject matter. So as I say, most psychologists are still insecure in copying the physical sciences stuff too much and ignoring the most important things. So for example, consciousness is a much more respectable thing to study now if your emphasis is on what are the brain correlates of consciousness. Because the brain is physical and objective, and you can measure it with machinery, and it looks very scientific and all that. And that leads to a kind of reductionism of bringing everything down to it's produced by the brain, which I think is actually not only scientifically inaccurate, but bad for human beings. If you're told essentially you're nothing but a meat computer, which is the materialistic, reductionistic sort of view, it's not only scientifically inaccurate, it doesn't do much for the human spirit. It doesn't do much to make you want to move forward in life or to look at the spiritual side of things. So in that way, psychology is still kind of not good for people in too many ways. Back in 1975, I had a book coming out, an anthology I'd put together, which was called Spiritual Psychologies. And it was based on the idea that in the many spiritual systems I've studied, every one of them had a psychology embedded in it, a whole set of ideas about the nature of the mind and how we learn things with it and what we do with it and what's healthy and whatnot. And I wanted to get people to write about their spiritual traditions as psychologies to make it more accessible to us. Well, the book was going off to the printers, and I got a call from my editor, and he said, I have good news and bad news. The good news is that the major psychology book club wants to adopt the book as its main selection when it comes out. I was very happy. That's wonderful. The bad news is that they say, psychologists cannot handle the word spiritual. They'll just freak out. They can't do it. Can we call it something else? So I said, right, we'll call it transpersonal psychologies. The word is almost synonymous, but at that time, nobody had heard of the word transpersonal, so people didn't have this conditioned reaction of, oh, that's weird, spiritual kind of stuff. So the book became Transpersonal Psychologies instead of Spiritual Psychologies. But that old word spiritual sums up a lot of what transpersonal is about. When people talk about altered states of consciousness, they sometimes mean something quite specific and meaningful, and sometimes they use the words in a real loose way that doesn't convey anything. I mean, sometimes they talk about state of consciousness to mean whatever's on your mind at the moment. Well, in that case, there's an infinite number of states of consciousness, and it doesn't mean anything. But I talk about states of consciousness as specific ways your mind is organized. The way your mind works when you're dreaming is quite different from the way it works in your ordinary waking state. It's quite different from if you're really angry, or quite different than if you're depressed, or quite different than if you're hypnotized. Those are all discrete, by which I mean separately formed, separately functioning states of consciousness. So I've tried to get people to describe these things better and to recognize when a state of consciousness is discretely different from another. So, for example, a state of anger, which is an altered state of consciousness if it's real strong. It's not if it's a little being peeved off at something, but if it's real strong. It might be very fine for defending yourself from a wild animal. Not at all fine for making up a lover's quarrel. What you can do, how you see the world, is affected by the state of consciousness you're in. So it behooves us to learn to recognize what state we're in, what's appropriate to do and not to do when we're in that state, and if we're in the wrong state for the situation we have to deal with, to try to bring ourselves into the appropriate state of consciousness for working with the situation. So for most of my work in altered states of consciousness, for instance, I've tried to experience at least something of particular states, so I have an inside idea of what it's about. If you don't have an inside idea, you can do awfully silly things. If you took a behaviorist approach to psychedelic drugs like LSD, for instance, you would probably say that most of the time they act like a sedative or a tranquilizer because people sit still and don't do anything for a long time. That's not what's happening. In thinking about altered states of consciousness, it became clear to me that we ordinarily make an assumption that our ordinary mental state is sort of the ultimate rational, sensible state. And everything I've learned about the way the mind works says that's not true. It's an interesting state. It's very good for a variety of things. It's not so good for other things. There are altered states of consciousness that are a rearrangement of the way the parts of the mind work that are better for some things than ordinary consciousness and worse than ordinary consciousness for other kinds of things. That's what I mean by altered states of consciousness. Now, science is an activity where we try to understand the nature of ourselves in the world. And we think of it as being practiced exclusively in our ordinary state of consciousness, where we're rational and objective and all that sort of thing. In actual fact, the inspirations in science often come in altered states of consciousness, but nobody talks about those. So what I proposed back in the 1970s was that we create state-specific sciences. That is, recognizing the mind as a tool. If someone's in an altered state, they have a different kind of tool that can do different things. Let's do science in those altered states. Let's find out what the world looks like from those kind of altered states, what kind of conclusions we come to. Not that any of those are necessarily better than ordinary state science, but they're different perspectives, and every perspective probably has something that contributes to our overall understanding. If you do something like, say, meditative practice within Buddhism, to take a particular example, you learn to change your consciousness in quite important ways and to investigate your mind from that altered perspective and to come up with different ideas about who you are, what the world is like, and so forth. So people have asked me the question, is that a state-specific science? Sounds like it. People get in an altered state, make observations, come up with ideas. Sounds like the basic stuff. And I'm not sure it is. I think it's actually a state-specific technology. If you think about it, when we think of a scientist, we think of someone who's asking fundamental questions and willing to question anything to see what's really true. Whereas technicians, they're told, the world is this way, now make it work efficiently in this part of it. I suspect something like Buddhism may be more like a state-specific technology. The framework is given as to what the world is like, and your job is to learn to function in that and achieve a certain kind of personal salvation, a certain kind of enlightenment within those parameters. So I'm not sure we have any state-specific sciences yet, except maybe mathematics. Several mathematicians have written to me, actually, that when they do mathematics, they're in a very funny state of consciousness. What they write up later in their journals has to make sense in an ordinary state of consciousness. But that's not how they actually do it. So I think certain kinds of mathematics may already be state-specific sciences. One of the things that happened in the late 50s and early 60s of the last century was that people had realized that ordinary social goodies don't lead to a deep enough happiness. They had the money, they had the sex, they had the jobs and all that, and they wanted more spiritual meaning. People were further finding out in our culture that for too many of them, our old religions didn't work. They told you to be good or else they didn't tell you how to be good. They tended to manipulate you through fear, and that wasn't going down very well with a lot of people. And then along came psychedelic drugs. And all of a sudden, first hundreds and then thousands and then hundreds of thousands of people were having the kind of mystical experiences that were the foundations of religion in the first place. That is, instead of getting it fourth hand, you know, I got it from a preacher who got it from his teachers in seminary school, who got it from his church elders, who got it from the results of a committee meeting 1,700 years ago. Instead of that watered-down, diluted, secularized kind of stuff, people were going directly to spiritual sources in a lot of their things. It was revolutionary for a lot of people. The simplest definition of meditation as I like to use the term, is that instead of letting your attention be used by what happens to you, this happens and you react that way, that happens and you react that way, and depending on your habits and your personal history and all that, instead of that, you decide to deliberately use your attention in a prescribed way. That's the essence of meditation practice. Now, it may be focusing on just learning to concentrate per se. So the simplest form of meditation in many spiritual traditions, for instance, is notice the sensation of breathing and stay there. Everybody will notice the sensation of breathing right away. You know, and a couple of seconds later, thinking about what to get at the grocery store or something more interesting. To learn to simply stay there, to learn to be able to consciously focus your mind. That's a major step in and of itself. That's one of the two main types of meditation. The other one is what's popularly called insight meditation, where having developed some ability to focus and stay focused in a calm, open way, you then start using it to examine your own nature, to examine usually at first your body, because that's a little bit easier, and then to start examining the contents of your mind. Not in an analytic way, not thinking about, you know, that person made me react like so, and I think that has to do with a childhood experience. That can be useful, but that's not what's usually meant by insight meditation. It's more being able to get a clearer perception of exactly what I'm feeling at a given moment. And then patterns and relationships start to emerge that begins a long-term process of psychological and spiritual growth. So that's what I generally mean by meditation. Learn first to focus, and then learning to use that focus as a kind of microscope to examine and understand yourself. A lot of people really mean prayer when they say meditation, incidentally. And prayer is asking somebody or someone or something outside yourself for help, and that's a fine thing to do. But that's not the same thing as training your own mind to act in a more stable way. One of the classes I teach here at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology is a class on mindfulness. Because it turns out that while we think we're mindful, a good deal of the time we're not paying very good attention to anything that's going on outside of us or inside of us. We don't know ourselves and we don't know our world. You know, a lot of spiritual traditions have expressed it as we live in a world of illusion. Not that the world's not real, but that our perception of it is so screwed up that we're effectively living in illusion. Or Gurdjieff put it as human beings are asleep, they're walking around in a dream. So I teach a basic course that begins with some of the classical meditation techniques of concentrative meditation to just teach people to be able to focus their minds for longer periods. Goes on to insight meditation or vipassana, where they try to learn to observe the range of phenomena happening inside them. But I especially go into mindfulness in everyday life along the lines taught by George Gurdjieff. I try to teach them how to deliberately use their attention to take in what's happening around them while staying anchored in their body so they know what's going on inside. And it produces some very interesting results at times. I mean, not only do people usually enjoy it because they feel that life becomes more vivid and more real, but they become more intelligent because they're in better touch with what's actually going on outside and inside. So the kind of thing you would see if you observed my mindfulness class would be exercises where I try to teach people various ways to be more mindful as part of everyday life. Right? I mean, I'm all for formal meditation, but nobody ever got in trouble sitting on a little black cushion in a quiet special meditation room. But people get in trouble all the time when they behave and open their mouth in everyday life because they're not really mindful of what they're doing and what they're feeling. Close your eyes. Let your attention settle down into your body, and particularly let your attention focus on your right foot, whatever sensation is there. And then move your attention up to the lower half of your right leg. Just focusing on whatever's there from moment to moment. And now shift up to the upper half of your right leg. This is much faster than we usually do it, but you can make this transition. Can meditation be dangerous? Anything can be dangerous in the certain circumstances. Some people shouldn't meditate. They're not stable enough to begin with. Some people shouldn't do certain kinds of meditation. The problem of trying to be more specific about that, though, is that, and this is one of my pet peeves as a scholar, the word meditation is used to cover so many different things, often contradictory, that it's almost useless. One of transpersonal psychology's big jobs that it's going to take many years to do is to classify the different kinds of meditation practices and to find out what kind works for what kind of person. So that eventually, someday, we might be able to say, for your personality type, don't do Zen meditation because too many people go off the deep end with it, not enough people feel they've spiritually grown, but this other kind of meditation is good for your personality type. We don't know anywhere near enough to be able to make those kind of recommendations at this point, but that's my hope for the future of our field. We'll know what works for what kind of person in what circumstances, instead of, well, this is what my teacher taught me, so I'll teach it to you, and let's hope it works. When I brought out my Altered States of Consciousness book back in 1969, I had a section on meditation, and I bragged in the introduction to that section that I was reprinting 2/3 of the English language scientific literature on meditation, which sounded very impressive to you. Realize it was 2 of the 3 articles that existed. There was almost no scientific research on meditation. Then, years later in the 70s, there was an article published in Science that found some physiological correlates of transcendental meditation. And all of a sudden, that legitimatized it for mainstream science. If it affected the brain and the body, maybe meditation is real instead of some weird thing that comes from the East. So it legitimatized research, and now there's more than probably 1,400, 1,500 scientific studies on meditation published, most of which are pretty lightweight. Most of them basically take some simple form of meditation and see if it helps in coping with stress. And it does. And that's fine. You know, it helps about as much as taking a nap or doing some exercise or something like that. Sort of it breaks the worry cycle. And that's fine, and people who want some stress relief should take up some simple forms of meditation. But that's not the real purpose of meditation. The real purpose is deep spiritual growth. There's still been hardly any research on that. When I had an opportunity to teach a workshop on meditation and mindfulness in life to people who were primarily scientists and scholars like me, I thought this is a very interesting challenge. It was especially difficult for me to learn any kind of meditation that involved calming and quieting my mind or mindfulness in life. But I'd finally gotten some degree of satisfaction out of it. You know, I'm no expert at it, but it makes a major difference in my... Could I teach it to other people like me who had those words running 1,000 miles an hour in their heads? So I did it 1 year at this conference called Toward a Science of Consciousness that's held in Tucson every other year. And it worked well. I got these people who were by and large hyper-intellectual to sit still, to have some insights about what was happening in their own minds, to have a taste of what it was like to be more mindful in life. So I thought, gosh, it's working. And it's working with an especially difficult group, right? The last kinds of people I would think would be prime candidates for learning any kind of meditation or mindfulness skills. So I've done it at each conference since then, and it's worked each time, and I'm very satisfied with it. I've spoken at scientific meetings and popular meetings for many years about parapsychology and spiritual stuff and transpersonal psychology. And inevitably, people come up to me afterwards to ask me questions or to tell me about their experiences. And so many times over the years, someone would come up and basically they would say, I'm a physicist or I'm a chemist or something like that, and I have never told any other person this experience before, but I had this experience of leaving my body or of mystical rapture or something like that. And they were sort of getting it off their chest for the first time. And it made me realize, you know, scientists are people too. They have mystical and psychic and transpersonal experiences just like other people, but they're in a culture that particularly puts them down and says, oh, those are signs of pathology or your mind is weakening. They can't be like what you experienced. So there's sort of a lot of pent-up experiences out there. So my website, TASTE, the Archives of Scientists' Transcendent Experiences, is a chance for scientists to anonymously, if they wish, tell their experience and maybe get a little feedback from others, but not be known by name unless they choose to, so people can't laugh at them or say, oh, that old chemist is getting senile if he thinks he had a talk with God or something like that. And I've got close to 100 experiences there now from various scientists in quite a few fields that run the whole gamut of transpersonal, mystical, psychic kinds of experiences. Scientists are just like people. So my website, in a sense, is out to destroy the cultural stereotype that scientists have no souls. I'd like them to be able to express their souls, too. People have credited me with defining the term, but I didn't. Scientism was a term invented by sociologists back in the early 1900s when they recognized that while science is supposed to be an open-ended inquiry with theories that are the best we can do at the time but nothing final, in point of fact, it's done by humans who get sort of certain and arrogant after a certain time. So, for instance, you should have been taught about the theory of gravity in high school physics. But nobody's taught about the theory of gravity. They're taught about the law of gravity. Do you ever wonder how that capital L law gets in there? It's not saying anything about the outside world. It's saying something about we get so sure about something that we're no longer open to questioning it. We think it's a law, an eternal principle. Well, at every stage of science, a lot of the scientists involved in it get ossified, get rigid in thinking, we've discovered everything that's important, we know how things are, and that's scientism. We put the ism in there in a sort of negative way to indicate it's like a fundamentalist religion or something like that. Instead of a set of theories, it's now we understand. Well, scientism is totally involved with the materialistic philosophy, and so it totally rules out the entire spiritual nature of human beings. If you have a spiritual experience and you go to a follower of scientism, who probably would never identify herself or himself as a follower of scientism, but as a scientist, because that's a higher prestige category, they would basically tell you, you know, there was something wrong with you if you had a spiritual experience. That damages human beings. I don't know how many people I've met over the years who had some powerful psychic or spiritual experience, and they expressed it to a doctor or a scientist or something like that, and they were put down for it. They were told, you know, they were probably mentally ill, and that didn't help them benefit from that experience, learn how to integrate it or grow from it, and it just made them feel bad about themselves. So scientism has real pernicious effects on people. It says, you're a meat brain. And as a psychologist, I think repressing a transpersonal or spiritual experience is just as unhealthy for you as repressing a negative experience. In fact, one of my recent graduate students, he's a PhD now, did his dissertation on what Jungians long ago called the bright shadow. You know, we ordinarily think of the shadow as all these negative, nasty parts of us that we disown and repress and all that. Well, it turns out some kids have full-blown mystical experiences, and they don't know what to do with it. They can't talk to their parents or people in their church and all that, and they repress this part of themselves, and it costs them in later life that they've repressed an important part of their spirit. I'd like to lift some of that repression. I developed an experiential exercise years ago to try to bring home to people how thoroughly we're all indoctrinated in scientism. You can't grow up in the modern world without having a lot of this scientism conditioned into you, whether you believe it or not, whether you think you're religious or not, it works below the surface. So I have people do something I call the Western Creed, which is a parody on religious creeds. I have people get up, put their hands on their hearts, stand at attention, and recite in unison with me, "I believe in the physical universe as the only and ultimate reality, a universe controlled by fixed physical laws and blind chance." And it goes on from there. And I've really taken what people think are basic physical laws and expressed them sort of like a religious creed. 95% of the people who do this are very depressed by the end of this exercise, because I've been asking them to watch their emotional reactions while they go along with it, because they discover that in many ways they believe this totally depressing view. They think it's the truth. And their spiritual aspirations are just nonsense in view of this. About 5% of people feel kind of relieved when I talk about the universe being meaningless. And I think these are people whose early religious training was basically, you're a sinner and going to hell. So it's a real relief to be told, no, that's all sort of nonsense. So scientism really has very strong negative effects on us. Now, I'm not knocking science. I love real science. I love the idea of keep going back to reality to find out what happens, and of course come up with theories about why it works, but keep checking them back against reality. That's wonderful. That's been one of the main thrusts of my life. But whenever it hardens into doctrines, into isms, into scientism, we're in trouble. That's crushing the human spirit. As I see it, parapsychology is to transpersonal psychology as physics is to engineering. That's the analogy I like to use. Physics determines fundamental properties of matter. Engineering works within those properties and builds useful structures out of it. Parapsychology is the hard branch of science, the rigorous branch of science, which shows that indeed the mind is not limited to the meat brain, that the idea that we might have a soul, that it might survive death, that feelings of union might be more than just a messing up of your brain, that's the fundamental science that says, yeah, under the best, toughest laboratory conditions, these things can happen. So when transpersonal psychology studies the effects they have on people, or how to make them occur more felicitously and so forth, that's like the engineering of it. So I really do think parapsychology is a fundamental science for transpersonal. Now, that is a minority viewpoint, because most transpersonal psychologists don't know that much about parapsychology, but it's one of the things that holds the field back. I mean, let's face it, to too many people, transpersonal psychology is a bunch of California flakes, right, who believe in all sorts of weird stuff like spirits or souls or God knows what. But parapsychology is our fundamental science that we base this on. I've given a lecture on this at a transpersonal conference. I hope to have an article coming out in the Journal of Transpersonal Psychology on this, and it's a theme I'm going to sound more and more over the years. When it comes to my feelings of personal identity, I consider myself primarily a transpersonal psychologist, because that's the biggest field of my interests. Within that very large field, I consider my work as a parapsychologist to be a kind of technical specialty within that kind of thing. But the transpersonal thing, what this stuff means for the human spirit, is really my primary interest, not just the technical parts of parapsychology. But it's true, lots of people consider me a leading parapsychologist, and it's true, but that's not how I like to picture myself. I also don't like to present myself as a parapsychologist because there's no legal restriction on who can call themselves a parapsychologist. So a lot of people with very weird ideas or not much sense of discrimination call themselves parapsychologists, and that reflects badly on the decent scientific work in parapsychology that some of my colleagues and I try to do. That sounds sort of elitist, and I don't like it to sound that way, you know, but when you've worked very hard to do rigorous, solidly based scientific stuff, and people come along with really these flaky ideas they mix in with it, it puts a bad atmosphere on the whole field. Parapsychologists are in a worse social position than transpersonal psychologists. Most transpersonal psychologists have sort of accepted the fact that we're kind of thought of as flaky, but meanwhile we do useful things to help people spiritually grow. So while it would be nice to have more acceptance by the establishment, it's not so crucial. Parapsychologists, who are a much smaller number than transpersonal psychologists, know that we need to do all sorts of basic research yet, but we're super rejected as parapsychologists by the establishment. You know, we're thought to all be incompetent or frauds or something like that. And so the desire for scientific acceptance is so strong. One fortunate result of this is that scientific parapsychology is probably the most rigorous field of science around. We do our studies far more carefully, controlling for more things than any other field of science. And that's been shown to be empirically true. But the unfortunate side of that wanting more scientific acceptance has been that we've tended to narrow ourselves more and more to what can be very rigorously studied and get conditions that are very artificial, just exist in the laboratory. And so some parapsychologists ending up taking what I think is far too defensive a stance with mainstream science. It's sort of like, oh, Mr. Real Scientist, I'm sorry to bother you, but I got this funny little statistical anomaly here that maybe you and your wisdom as a physicist or something could explain to me. And that's the attitude of losers. And in point of fact, parapsychology is about these very important phenomena of the human mind transcending known physical limits. And presenting ourselves as losers just reinforces the prejudice that gets us rejected as parapsychologists in the first place. So to try to get away from this position as either losers or as so narrow that we only talk about these complex statistical analyses, I persuaded a bunch of my colleagues with wider interests to start talking about the implications of parapsychology for spirituality. And the result is, I think, one of the most interesting books I've ever edited, because the implications are important. If we accept telepathy as real, for instance, and as far as I'm concerned as a scientist, anyone who doesn't accept telepathy as real is ignorant or prejudiced, because there's lots of excellent evidence for it. Once we accept that as real, if somebody now says to me, I prayed for such and such to happen, I'm not going to automatically dismiss that as, oh, this poor fellow talked to himself inside his head, wasting his breath. Maybe he did. We certainly talk to ourselves a lot and waste our breath. But maybe that reached out in a telepathic kind of way to something bigger than we can understand at the moment. To me, that says that prayer is worth studying in and of itself, not to be automatically dismissed as something that a scientistic view of the world, a materialistic view of the world, automatically dismisses as worthless. When the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology was first started by Bob Fraser, it was unique in that it said we're going to educate people in three areas. One area is intellectual. And that's what any conventional graduate school does. Talk power, concepts, theories, and whatnot. That's fine. But also we were going to educate people emotionally. And the whole concept of emotional intelligence was still unheard of in psychology at that time. You're supposed to put your emotions aside and be rational in mainstream stuff. But to educate people's emotions. And that's a powerful process and a transformative process. And we were going to educate people's bodily intelligence by requiring them to take Aikido or Tai Chi. That's revolutionary too. In mainstream schools, people don't have any bodies. They don't have any emotions. Those are supposed to be gotten rid of before you get there, kept under check. But it makes for a much more well-rounded person. We do have bodies. We do have emotions, you know. And now we add educating people spiritually. We want everyone to have some kind of personal spiritual practice, for instance. There's no prescribed one. It can be what appeals to them, but we want them to be serious about spiritual growth. You know, we want to educate their creativity, their social skills, and things like that. So it's a much more rounded education. some research in transpersonal psychology looks a lot like more conventional psychological research, but there often is a unique flavor, and that's in valuing the experiences of individuals. So, for instance, a conventional psychological study is likely to have a questionnaire, true, false, this, that, and the other thing. A transpersonal one is more likely to be, let's sit down together for an hour. After I put you at ease and you feel I'm a person I can trust, I want to interview you about certain kinds of experiences you have. And then I may go away and work on that interview and try to make sense of it. But then I'm going to come back to you with my conclusions and say, okay, does this make sense to you? Did I draw out what you were intending to do? Or have I twisted it in terms of my own theories or needs or something like that? A transpersonal psychologist is much more likely, for instance, to realize I am my research instrument. It's not that there's some measuring instruments out there and it's all very objective. I'm part of this experiment, and I'm probably biased. So I better figure out, why am I in this? What are my biases? What are my hopes and fears? And can I compensate for those to really try to get at what's really happening here? So there's much more of a recognition that the researcher is likely to be personally involved in the research. And this is actually the shadow side of conventional psychology. We want so much, speaking as a conventional psychologist now, we want so much to be considered real scientists who do objective research. And yet there was very powerful research done on experimenter bias back in the 60s. I did some of it myself. And it showed that even while we're pretending to be objective, we may be biasing our results quite strongly. Well, psychologists don't want to hear this. I'm amazed that this whole area of research has kind of gotten repressed and forgotten, and psychologists just think of themselves as objective now rather than dealing with this. To me, you know, I know, for instance, I'm biased. I have my preferences. I prefer things to come out. I also really would like to get at truth. So whenever I've designed an experiment, I've tried to sit down and think, how am I biased? Let me get specific about this. Given those biases, what might I do to nudge things in that direction which is not compatible with really getting at the truth? By admitting that I'm biased and studying that, then I have a chance to compensate and a better chance to get at the truth. But if I just pretend I don't have a bias problem, the biases run rampant in the background. Transpersonal psychologists are much more likely to recognize their own biases and try to do something about it. Transpersonal psychology at this early stage of existence draws very heavily on Eastern psychology and meditative practice, yes. And that's both good and bad. It's good in the sense of we've gotten certain technologies and ideas and practices already developed over thousands of years, as it were, so that we can begin using right away. And it's bad in the sense that we're not sure which of them are really good. I teach a lot of the first-year students. They take my mindfulness class. And usually the first class, I welcome them to ITP, and I tell them, incidentally, we're going to teach you all sorts of wonderful, spiritual, vital, important stuff. And, oh, probably at least 50% of what we teach you is nonsense, and we don't know which 50% that is. And they're sort of shocked. But I tell them, you know, we've borrowed a lot from these other cultures and the like, and we don't know which parts are really essential at this point and which parts might have been great if you were an 18th century Persian but don't work for a 21st century Californian. Our research agenda is to refine that. The reason I tell students this is to pep them up for their dissertation someday, that you're going to help contribute to sorting out the wheat from the chaff. What's an essential transpersonal technique, and what is very old and holy but doesn't really work anymore, and we should drop it. There's been a lot of resistance to transpersonal psychology from conventional mainstream psychology, and it varies, of course, you know, tremendously. Some individuals welcome it and adapt some of the stuff. and others are very resistant to it. There was resistance to having a division of transpersonal psychology form within the American Psychological Association, for instance, sufficient resistance that such a division has still not been formed. And I can only speculate about the causes of that resistance, because by and large I don't know the people who are resisting. But I think in some cases it's a personal level of resistance. If I say I'm a transpersonal psychologist and I study spiritual development, and you long ago, say, got disenchanted with your childhood religion and turned against that, and there's nothing spiritual in your life, at some level, my very existence threatens you. You know, because my very existence says you're missing the mark. Any unhappiness in your life is liable to be activated further by that. Maybe your life is empty or unhappy or not going right because you've not done the spiritual things you should have. Childhood spirituality and religion, too, I think can really be very intense sometimes, and it's not like it all gets resolved. A lot of times it gets repressed. You know, everybody probably knows someone, you know, who was a child, they had a best friend who was dying, and they prayed as fervently as they could to God to save the friend's life and promised they'd be good, and the friend died. And sometimes what that comes down to is then the person really turns against the idea of God. Now, that's probably repressed, that intense emotional reaction, and they think of apparently rational reasons for being atheistic or agnostic later. But that psychodynamic is down there. And then when along come people who say, I'm a scientist and I'm studying spirituality, that's kind of threatening. Let's find some way to reject that kind of person. So I think there's an irrational core of resistance there too. I think the same thing with parapsychological phenomena. There's a lot of irrationality in the kind of resistance against it. The people who are the most outspoken critics of parapsychology, for instance, the ones I call the pseudo-skeptics, to be technically accurate, because they're not really skeptical, they're really just the opposition. They do all these irrational things that they accuse parapsychologists of doing, saying they're working for a higher cause. You know, they get positive results in an ESP experiment, and they suppress it, so they accuse us of suppressing negative results. It really gets very illogical and very weird at times. You know there have got to be a lot of intense psychological dynamics going on underneath. Now, that's not to say, you know, we can just do that kind of putting the other person down rather than dealing with the rationality of arguments. There are rational arguments about controls on experiments that need to be handled sometimes, but this kind of attacking researchers is all too common. One of the things we're struggling with right now is a lot of our graduate students here at the Institute want to have our clinical program get American Psychological Association approval, because that's going to increase their employability. And I can understand that. You spend years and a lot of money going through graduate school. You want to be employable. But at the same time, when you adhere to APA standards, it starts crowding out transpersonal stuff. And we don't want to have a program that's approved by the mainstream but is transpersonal in name only. We really want to continue doing our transformative and transpersonal sort of work here, and it's a dilemma exactly how to balance these. It's hard to talk about how legitimate transpersonal psychology is, because I think it depends who and where you're talking to. So, for instance, our graduate students who specialize in clinical sort of stuff tend to get particularly high ratings when they go out for clinical internships as being very good in working with people. And so for people who direct clinics and mental health facilities elsewhere, transpersonal, schmanspersonal, they don't care. Our people are good at working with people. That's the bottom line that it comes down to it. Other places we see some kind of things that were associated with transpersonal psychology getting absorbed into the mainstream, you know, like meditation as a stress reliever. That's being used in an awful lot of conventional places because it works. And they're not thinking about the spiritual implications of it. But at a scientific level, transpersonal psychology is still not legitimatized. It's kind of seen as flaky kind of stuff. And I don't see that as changing soon, unfortunately.